about shame, shame, shame. It's the name of her game. There's so much to do, and we're gonna speak true. So many to blame, blame, blame. So we're throwing out shame. Could be throwing at you. What you gonna do?
Hello, hello. I should say hello again and hello for the third time because we are coming to you once again from the dedicated podcast room in downtown Chicago at lovely and accommodating and talented BAM Studios. We are about to start our third podcast called Shame on You because we are here today to talk about sexual abuse. Aren't you glad you tuned in? I've got my partners and good friends here, Derek Hopkins
hello.
And Tom Andreessen.
Hey, Gene.
So if we're getting together for the third time to talk about the shocking incidence of sexual violence in our culture and the even more shocking lack of funding and other resources that are being devoted to its prevention. We talked the last time. We threw a lot of numbers at you. The most important one is still that the federal government thinks it's worth funding this issue at $12 per person. I would like to just add to that a little bit because I think I left it out the last time. We are talking about, it says in fiscal year 2015, state and local child protective services agencies received 4 million calls or other referrals alleging abuse, which involved 7.2 million children. After screening, they decided that response was warranted for 2.2 million of the referrals. So that brings us to a number of 3.4 million children. So that was how we got to the number that we used when we divided up the amount of federal money that was allocated under CAPTA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and that's how we came to $12 per child. And as we were talking, you know, this is not only just the reported cases, which leaves out the unreported cases, but these are also the cases that were not dismissed. Many, many others, almost as many were dismissed as the ones that were allocated towards further investigation. So as shocking as these numbers are, they're not complete because we're still leaving out a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to review that because I still, every time I read this, I think I've, you know, gone into the Twilight Zone or something. I read a lot of science fiction. Sometimes I think that the timeline is fractured and, like, I'm the only person that
yeah,
knows
right.
it.
Well,
so that's one of my current theories on how are we living in a world where we sit and in our chairs and we're being told that this happens to 1 out of 3 children and here's the amount of money that's being allocated to prevent it and treat it and someday maybe make it go away.
Well, that $12 since our last time we talked is probably worth less now.
Right.
Fewer minutes of treatment.
More cases.
Yeah.
More cases, less money.
Less money, less fuel cost to actually get somebody some help. I mean, just since we've talked, that amount of money goes less and less.
Right.
$12.
And I'm thinking with the $12 number, that's on out of those 7 million cases, out of the ones that they deemed worthy.
Worthy.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's assume that they did that with 100% efficiency. Like they were not, all the ones they deemed unworthy, actually nothing happened to those kids. Again, like we talked about last time, what about the ones that went unreported?
Right.
That, you know.
It's astounding.
Even if it's 50% of that, then we're dealing with, you know, then that number is going to go down drastically.
Yeah.
That $12 is all of a sudden, now that's like $7. Now that's like $6 a person, $6 a kid.
And I think we've talked about, you know, just imagine what COVID has done to these numbers and how many cases are going to go unnoticed, not get reported. It just has to be, this is going to come out in years ahead of us about what has happened during COVID. And I think those numbers are just going to skyrocket.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, just terrible.
If anybody here is listening that is working for the government,
Hello. You haven't turned us off by now.
Yeah, right. Email me.
And if you did, shame on you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
I want to put initiative together. I just had this idea. Moment of inspiration. I want to put initiative together to track from when COVID started to when COVID ended, when kids were allowed back in school, inner cities, let's try to figure out whatever metrics we can to figure out how successful are these kids going to be in their life?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how many of those kids are going to wind up in prison? How many of those kids are going to wind up on the street? How many of those kids are going to wind up in, mental institutions? How many of those kids are going to wind up being successful people, right? Like, the class of COVID. Let's see how that turns out, because my intuition tells me it's going to be really bad.
Yeah.
Because they were locked in their homes with their abusers. It just can't be good.
Yeah, every once in a while, Derek, I find a statistic of my own. I've got one here that was put together from a recent annual report by the Zacharias Center in Gurnee, Illinois. National hotlines show that 79% of child callers report living with their abusers. 79%. And this is before COVID.
Right.
So now these callers are not only living with their abusers, they don't get to escape them by going to school. They don't get to escape them by going to preschool or after school or summer programs.
Mm.
They are home day in, day out with their abusers. I lost track of the number of people who said something to me along the lines of, well, at least people are safer at home during COVID. No, they're not.
Not at all.
No, they're not. It's the absolute opposite.
79%, though. That's an amazing statistic, too.
At present, sexual assaults are the most prevalent crimes in the U.S., yet also the most underreported. Every 68 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted. Every 9 minutes, that person is a child. What
some
do we
heavy,
do?
Some heavy, heavy numbers again.
You know what I'm going to, for the next time, I'm gonna find the gun violence statistics. Gun violence, and then something else to compare that to, so people
Absolutely.
Can have something
That'd
to compare. Something can have somebody compare that to, because it's.
Derek's our research guru.
Yeah, you know, I've been working with this a long time, and I can. It seems to me that when people first started quoting statistics at me, they were talking. I don't think it was 1 in 10. People were talking about 1 in 8, and those days people weren't even talking about the boys because this was a woman's issue. I was just making air quotes for all of you out there who can't see me.
There's some nice air quotes, Gene.
and over the years, that number would change. And then people would start saying something like 1 in 8 boys, 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 3 girls. We're just saying 1 in 3 now. Maybe it's worse. Maybe it's 1 in 2. The numbers keep changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just cannot wrap my head around it because, I collect the stupid things that people say to me. And believe me, I got a lot of them. But people would always say to me, well, maybe I'm just lucky, but I don't know anyone who's been affected by that. I can't think of anybody I know who fits that category. Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you do. My girlfriend and I were talking the other day about what does 1 in 3 really mean? It means if you go to the doctor's office and you're sitting in the waiting room and there's 5 people there, someone's been sexually abused.
Well, and I, this goes back several years ago. A friend of mine, a dad, was talking about his daughter who had been part of the school, part of a trainer of one of the sports teams, had been sexually assaulted by one of the players. And he was bringing it up to me and asking, he was just in tears talking about it and was, can you believe this happened? Can you believe this happened at school, after school, practice was done. And he was just so torn by it. He was almost feeling guilty about it for his daughter, that happening and not being there for her. So I was fortunate able to refer him to an agency where I was on the board.
Mm-hmm.
This is not most recently, so several years ago. But it was just, again, he said, I've never felt I was that close to the issue. And he said, now I have a child that has. And I was like, hey, listen. The stats are you really were closer than you knew.
Yeah.
And you knew somebody that was. You just didn't know it. And now he had something directly that impacted him. But it was just one of those things where, you know, I'm so horrible it happened, but you were actually closer based on the statistics. You knew somebody. You actually knew somebody. You just didn't know it.
Right.
But they were, it isn't that far from you. That's the astounding implications of what we're dealing with sexual assault.
The first headline-making case that I can remember involving the athletic programs, university-level athletic programs, was Penn State. I mean, maybe there were more before that, but that was the first one that I remember getting national attention. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, you know, I heard this from, like, my husband and every other guy that I associate with and the male sports writers and the Chicago papers over and over again. It was this total disbelief. How could this have happened? And then the favorite phrase was, at Penn State of all places. And I would go, what makes Penn State of all places? Why is it so impossible that it could have happened at Penn State? This is how it happens. You have people in power, you have a pool of potential victims, and this is how it works. You know, what was magic about Penn State? Oh, well, Joe Paterno, that would never have happened under his watch. People, it did happen to under his watch. You know, I guess I'm not the biggest sports fan, although I root for my Chicago teams. And I don't claim to understand, sorry guys, male mentality. But there seemed to be this horror and this, like, loss of innocence for guys when they heard that it happened at a respected sport winning, mm-hmm. a respected university with a winning tradition. And of course, I live in a different world, you know, doesn't surprise me. It's the Catholic Church. It's the next door neighbors. It's everywhere and anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, could you guys comment on that a little bit? I think you're both sports fans. Is there a special shock or horror when it's not the Catholic Church and it's not the daycare center, but it's a sports program?
It's a lot of money in sports. And, you know, again, I think it's not just at higher ed. I think you have it happening in schools related to, you know, sports, and things happen. And the public schools, private schools, it's a hard thing that when it comes that close to something that should be all about the sport, the athletic, the winning, losing, but that teaming aspect. But I think at the higher ed perspective, it was shocking that when it happened at Penn State under such a prestigious, well-known coach. But then when you started to peel it back, you started to understand there were a lot of layers and complexities to it. There are a lot of reasons for it not to become known. And again, it's, you know, being an alum of an institution where something like that happens, and it's happened, as we know, since then, it's a hard thing, and you feel that, how can that happen at our school? And it's kind of the same thing. How could that happen
in my family?
In my family or my neighborhood? And it's kind of that same thing. I don't know, Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, I was going to ask Derek. You're the youngest one here, probably the most.
Not by that much, Gene. Not that far. It's close.
Probably the most. You look pretty athletic to me. So, you know, do you think that people just assume, well, we're talking about strong, athletic young men here?
Mm-hmm.
If something's happening, they'll either deck the guy,
right,
or they'll go on social media and report it. That, you know, I know that you have thought and spoken about this sort of thing a lot. So.
Well, and kind of in keeping with what you guys are saying with the sports part of it, a lot of times, at least from like the research that I've seen, a lot of times the younger men that get abused, like when it's happening, they're absolutely mortified. So you think that they like start punching people, but not everybody's like that. But I was kind of, when you guys were talking, I was thinking about like when I was a kid growing up, my idol was Derek Jeter. He used to play for the New York Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking about it, like, what if when I was a kid, Derek Jeter was, you know, starting a charity, and the charity happened to be, you know, we're going to fight child sexual abuse. As a little kid, I would have been like, whatever you say, Derek Jeter, let's do it, right? So I was kind of thinking about people's relationship with the media. And if you had really prominent male athletes up in front of microphones, you know, on their social media talking about, let's get proactive about this, it kind of takes the sting out of it. out of the whole thing, everybody would just kind of be like, yeah, whatever he said, let's do mm-hmm. it. You know, because I feel like at least when it comes to sports, men are kind of like, well, I'm just going to do what that guy's going to do. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm just part of the team. Go Bears. You know what I mean? So,
but this gets into, you know, why when we talk about why there's not more funding, why it's hard maybe in the corporate world to get behind it, why, you know, the federal government, it's a hard issue to get on a podium, I would think. And corporations, it's not an easy topic to talk about and to fund. And there are other causes which, you know, maybe from a headlines perspective, are a little bit easier and not be, you know, as emotional to get behind. But that's where I struggle with why can we not get funding for a cause for something that impacts so many and impacts whether it's the business world or personal lives. And we've talked through the numbers. The numbers are astounding. So why can we not get funding behind this? So $12, you know, that's nothing. And we should, this impact should be felt, you know, at the personal level. It should be felt in the corporate level. It should be felt in our higher ed. And it's a difficult topic. It's an uncomfortable topic. And it's why we're doing this.
Well, you've had more experience than I think either one of us have. You've been in a position where you've probably pretty directly, asked somebody for money. When you were mm-hmm. the chairman of the board at Resilience, you were probably at events.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you were talking to somebody who was, what, thinking of a donation,
mm-hmm.
maybe on the fence. I mean, what do people actually say to you about why they don't?
Well, a lot of it's what we're talking about. They just don't know of anybody, supposedly,
okay.
right? And the statistics may be there, but they feel like they've been lucky or they are fortunate that they haven't known somebody or they themselves are not a survivor. You know, people can feel easier about, I know somebody that has had cancer. Hey, I do this walk every year for this cause. It's a national cause and it's, you know, easy to get behind it because they know somebody else in the city or somebody else in another city that's doing that same walk. And it feels like they're part of something big, a cause that's, you know, there's names behind. This one's a tough one because unless they know of somebody or feel like they've got a personal attachment to it, it's just a harder thing to get the money flowing in for it.
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up. I wonder how much of it is related to there aren't enough options for ways that you can show support. Like you mentioned, mm-hmm. You mentioned a walk. You know, if there were a national walk, you know, then somebody, if you're trying to convince them that they need to do something and they don't feel like giving you money or whatever, they can go walk and then they can feel like they've done something.
Mm-hmm.
But our issue, we don't have the walks. We don't have the Derek Jeters.
Right.
You know, there's basically only one thing we can ask people for, and that's their money.
Right.
And, well, you know, it's not an easy thing for a lot of people to give up.
And yeah. I think we have a lot of agencies supporting survivors, but you're kind of splitting up, you know, kind of a brand across multiple agencies. And, you know, when you're an agency vying for dollars as well, that becomes hard to say, hey, you know, here's my world and my donor base, and that's their donor base, and it starts to just splinter it. So you wonder, like, can we somehow get a common theme and a common cause where it gets elevated, and therefore it's not splintered across an already challenged donor base to give money,
mm-hmm.
and that's where some of these causes they're elevated enough in a metro area. In a state, nationally, everybody can get behind it. There's one site to go give, and it's for that cause. And that's the tough thing about this, too, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I've talked to Gene about this a couple times. It's like my nonprofits, we're really small, and it's mainly Alan, my partner, that co-founded it with me. It's me and him, and it's us putting it in there. And then, you know, as I met Gene donated to me several times, and to a childhood fractured, and then I start talking to Gene about the back end of the nonprofit sector, what's actually going on. And then, you know, then I met you, and then it's like there's all these different organizations, and it's almost like it's like in a it's got like a for-profit kind of slant to it. It's like you're our competition. You're the competition. We got to outperform you. We got to out-fundraise you. We got to, you know, I don't know if people are poaching each other's fund, their whoever their donors are. I don't know if that's going on. Seems like it is, but I don't know. And it's like instead of focusing on the mission, everybody's focusing on out-competing and making sure that they protect whatever sources of income they have, which I understand, but I don't think it's getting the job done.
No. Well, it's Puzzler. I'm a smart person. If there were an easy answer, I would have figured it out by now. And the one thing I keep going back to is, you know, I think we are a country that cherishes its myths. You know, still the best way to make a movie is to tell them it's going to be a Western.
Yeah.
You know, Star Trek, they got a chance to make a second pilot because they were going to be the wagon train to the stars. You know, and I watch the Dr. Phil show a lot, I confess. You know, people...
Shame on you.
The divorce rate is crazy. And you'll see people talking about their marriages and someone will say, well, did you discuss how many children did you want to have? Did you discuss how you were going to share how the children be raised? What religion? Did you discuss sharing household George? And people are going like, oh, no, we didn't talk about that. Let's see. You decided to get married and you didn't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same kind of magical thinking. You know, no, we were in love. It's romantic. Talking about those things isn't love and romance. That's work and it's crap and it's reality. And no, we just wanted to get married. I mentioned that because it feels to me all the time like this is what we are dealing with sexual abuse. People buy into the myth that our children are the most valuable things to us. We protect them. We nurture them. We help them to grow. And if you look at the numbers and you look at our response to it as a society, you would have to stop believing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and who wants to think they're not protecting their children? Nobody.
Nobody.
That's a good point.
Nobody.
Oh, I've said it many, many times over the years. So here I am, America, saying it again. And if you don't believe me, you know what?
I think they should get used to
that S-word, Well, we've covered an awful lot of territory here today, and, you know, it's serious, it's sobering. I am so grateful to have such steadfast and helpful and contributing and encouraging partners. I've been doing this work alone for 25 years, and I've never had the opportunity to join in with, you know, with the kind of people who think the way I do and who are anxious to kind of like tackle it in a new way. So I just want to say I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to my friend who listened to our podcast and let it spark a conversation with her son. I'm grateful to any of you out there who takes even a few minutes to listen to our podcast because this is not easy stuff to talk about. This is not easy stuff to think about. I know we sound like we are comfortable dealing with it, but we're not. It brings up memories for me. It brings up memories for Derek. And Tom is a compassionate, caring person, so it wounds him too. Just would like to say once again, thank you for listening. We're not going away. We got lots more ideas, lots more plans, and we want to share them with you. So listen to us, or you know what will happen? You'll be really ashamed of yourself. We've been talking about shame, shame, shame. It's the name of the game. Now the podcast through, what you gonna do? So many to blame, blame, blame. We've been throwing out shame. Did we throw some at you? What you gonna do? What you gonna do?